All right, diving right in today. We're going deep on the idea of the people of God in the Old Testament.
Okay, sounds good.
It's really about understanding, you know, how God's covenants, those special agreements he makes, and those huge moments of rescue shaped who Israel was way back then.
Right, yeah.
So think of this as a crash course, a fast track to understanding some really foundational stuff.
I like it. A crash course.
Yeah. We're mainly drawing from Dr. Robert A. Peterson's Church and Last Things. Good series, by the way.
Yeah, I've heard good things.
Especially Session 4, Part 2. He really focuses in on this people of God idea.
Okay, great. So where do we start?
Well, I think the goal here is to help you grasp how the people of God were defined back then.
Okay, yeah. Makes sense.
Through those covenants and those incredible acts of God stepping in and saving the day.
Right, right. Because those aren't just events.
Exactly. They shape their identity, their whole understanding of who they were.
For sure. Okay, so people of God in the Old Testament. Let's unpack that.
Yeah, let's start with a big one. The Davidic covenant.
Okay, the Davidic covenant. Yeah, everyone always talks about that.
You know, if you just crack open 2 Samuel 7, that's where it's laid out the word covenant. Mm-hmm. It doesn't actually appear there.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. But other verses, other parts of the Bible, they look back at that chapter.
Like where? What are some examples?
Well, you've got 2 Samuel 23.5, 1 Kings 8.23, 2 Chronicles 13.5.
Okay, okay. I'm seeing it.
Even Psalms 89, Isaiah 55, Jeremiah 33, they all point back and say, yep, that's a covenant.
So it's understood as a covenant, even though the word isn't explicitly used in that chapter.
Exactly. So what's the story there? Well, David's sitting pretty.
Literally.
Yeah, literally. Cedar Palace, you know, the good life. But he looks over and God's dwelling in a tent.
Hmm. That wouldn't sit right with me either.
And it didn't with him. He's like, this is wrong. I got to build God a house, a permanent one, a temple.
Okay. Makes sense. What happened?
But here's the twist. God's response is not what you'd expect. He's like, David, I'm going to build you a house.
Whoa, really?
Yeah. Not a literal house.
Right. A dynasty, a lineage.
Exactly. A lasting dynasty. So there's this play on words, right? The idea of house. Mm-hmm. It's key to the whole thing.
That's fascinating. So God's not focused on a physical building?
Nope. He's promising David something much bigger.
Yeah.
And that's spelled out in 2 Samuel 7.1:11.
So God's the one doing the building, not David.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he reminds David, hey, remember you were just a shepherd. Humble beginnings, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Not the one who made you leader. But the promises don't stop there.
There's more.
Oh, yeah. God pledges to give David rest from all his enemies. All of them.
That's a big promise.
Huge. And he's going to make his name great. You know, like super famous, respected.
Wow. That's quite the honor.
It is. And Peterson points out this is the kind of honor God gave Abraham in Genesis 12 and Moses in Numbers 12.
Oh, wow. So David's in good company.
The best. But wait, there's more. God also promises to give Israel a permanent place.
Okay, their own land.
Exactly. Their own land where they can be safe, undisturbed. Peterson connects this directly to Jerusalem.
Ah, the city of David. It all starts to come together.
It does. It's all connected.
So rest from enemies, a great name, a secure land.
Yeah, think about it. What would that mean for a nation always facing threats, always struggling for recognition?
Yeah, that's huge. It speaks to their deepest longings, you know, for peace, security, lasting identity.
Totally. And here's another connection Peterson brings up. Remember the Abrahamic covenant?
Of course, yeah.
God promised Abraham descendants, a nation, right?
Right.
Well, the Davidic covenant has that same element of lasting descendants.
So there's a link between the two.
Absolutely. Peterson quotes Walt Kess, who says the Davidic covenant sort of supplements the Abrahamic one.
Okay, how so?
It's like God promised Abraham a nation, and then he promises David an enduring dynasty to rule that nation.
Oh, I see. So they fit together like pieces of a puzzle.
Exactly. And get this. Those kings promised to Abraham way back when they would eventually come from David's line.
Wow. So it's all woven together, this bigger story unfolding.
Right. And this brings us to Solomon.
David's son.
Yep. God tells David, Solomon, he's going to build that house for my name. That temple David wanted to build.
Okay.
And his throne. Yeah. Established forever. That's in 2 Samuel 7.13. But here's the kicker.
Oh, there's always a kicker.
Right. There's this huge difference between David's line and King Saul's line. Remember Saul?
Oh, yeah. The first king.
Yeah. God took his favor away from Saul because of, well, disobedience.
He didn't exactly follow the rules.
Nope. He did his own thing. But God makes a different promise to David.
Okay, what's that?
He says, "My love won't depart from your line like it did from Saul's," even when they mess up.
Wow, that's powerful.
It's a powerful promise. It's in 2 Samuel 7.1415, unconditional love.
So even when David's descendants messed up, God would still be faithful.
Exactly. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
And that raises this whole question about the nature of this covenant.
Okay, yeah. How does that work?
Peterson brings in Waltkin again. He clarifies that the Davidic covenant, the promise itself, it's unconditional.
Okay, so God will keep his word no matter what.
Exactly. God will establish David's house, his kingdom, his throne, eternally.
That's what it says in 10 Samuel 7.16.
But here's the thing. Experiencing the blessings of that covenant, that's a different story.
Oh, okay. I see where you're going with this.
Right. That depends on obedience. Following God's laws, the Ten Commandments.
So it's not a free pass to do whatever you want.
Not at all. It's like, hey, I'm making this promise, but you got to hold up your end of the deal.
Makes sense. So the kings in David's line, they had to be obedient to really experience the fullness of the covenant.
Exactly. God's promise stands, but how much they benefit from it, that depends on them.
That's a really important distinction.
It is. So at its core, the Davidic covenant is all about this eternal house, kingdom, and throne for David's line.
Right.
But you know what's amazing? It's huge for understanding the Messiah.
Oh, absolutely. The coming Savior.
Peterson quotes Gordon, who calls it the matrix of biblical messianism.
Wow, that's a big word.
It basically means it's the foundation, the blueprint for all those prophecies about a future king.
So what the prophets and psalmists wrote about...
All those promises find their fulfillment in Jesus.
Who, of course, is a descendant of both David and Abraham.
Exactly. That's what Matthew 1.1 makes clear. So you see, this covenant, it points forward to Jesus.
And how does David react to all of this? I mean, it's pretty overwhelming, right?
Peterson points out something really interesting. In David's prayer after God makes these promises,
which is in 2 Samuel 7,
he calls himself God's servant 10 times.
10 times.
10 times.
Right.
He's so humbled. He's blown away by God's greatness and uniqueness. That's in verse 22.
He realizes the weight of it all. It's not about him.
Right. And he even praises God for rescuing Israel from Egypt, you know, acknowledging all God has done.
So he's recognizing God's faithfulness throughout history, not just focusing on his own blessings.
Exactly. It's a beautiful picture of humility and gratitude.
Yeah, that's really powerful.
It is. And in the last part of his prayer, David puts his full trust in God's promises.
Yep.
That's 2 Samuel 7.25-29.
He has complete faith that God will do what he said.
And this covenant, it's not just some ancient story. Peterson quotes Walt Nanke again, who says that God's chosen king, Jesus Christ, is fulfilling those promises right now.
Wow.
He reigns from heaven over an eternal kingdom. And Peterson even points us to Revelation 22.3.
Oh, the new earth.
Yeah. The ultimate fulfillment of this covenant is still to come. It's going to be amazing.
That's incredible. So from the Davidic covenant, where do we go next?
Well, naturally, this leads us to the new covenant. You know, Peterson calls it the crown and the goal.
Okay, yeah.
Or, to use a fancy word, the telos of all the covenants that came before.
Like the culmination, the ultimate purpose.
Exactly. And Peterson quotes Lane, who wrote a commentary on Hebrews. Lane describes it as the realization of this deep relationship between God and his people.
And isn't that really the heart of all the covenants, that relationship?
Absolutely. It's like a recurring theme. Peterson even illustrates it, you know, that phrase, "I will be their God and they will be my people."
Yeah, I remember that.
It pops up in the Abrahamic covenant, Genesis 17.7.
Okay. And in the Mosaic covenant, too.
Right. Exodus 6.7. It's in the Davidic covenant, 2 Samuel 7.13.
And, of course, in the new covenant itself.
Yep. Jeremiah 31.31. It's like a thread running through all of them, connecting them together.
It really highlights the consistency of God's heart, his desire for relationship with his people.
Totally. And while Jeremiah 31.3134 is the most well-known passage about the new covenant,
the one where it explicitly says new covenant. Right?
Exactly. Peterson reminds us that there are other Old Testament texts that hint at this idea of a renewed relationship with God.
Oh, okay. Like which ones?
You've got Jeremiah 32, Ezekiel 36, and Joel 2.
Yeah.
They don't use the exact words new covenant, but they touch on the same themes.
So even before Jeremiah 31, there was this sense that God was going to do something new.
Exactly. It's like a building anticipation. Huh. Okay, so back to Jeremiah 31.3134. God says the days are coming.
The days are coming.
Right. It's a big statement. And then he goes on, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah.
Okay.
Not like the one I made with their ancestors. My covenant that they broke.
Oh, that's strong. God calls himself their husband, and they broke the covenant.
Powerful imagery. And this new covenant, it's packed with promises.
What kind of promises?
God says, I will put my law within them and write it on their hearts.
Wow.
Right. Not just external rules, but something internal written on the heart.
That's a whole new level of intimacy.
It is. He also promises, I will be their God and they will be my people.
There it is again.
That core relationship. And then, get this, they will all know me from the least of them to the greatest.
Universal knowledge of God.
Yeah. And he'll forgive their wickedness and remember their sins no more.
Total forgiveness. That's incredible.
It's a game changer. Now, Peterson points out something about that phrase, the days are coming.
Yeah, what about it?
Sometimes it means something that's going to happen soon, right?
Okay.
But here, especially when you consider how Hebrews 8 quotes this whole passage.
In relation to Jesus.
Exactly. Oh. It's clear that this is talking about a long-term fulfillment.
So it's not just a quick fix, but something that will unfold over time.
Right. And speaking of Hebrews, that book really helps us understand the superiority of the new covenant.
Okay, how so?
Well, Peterson quotes Lane again, who suggests that it wasn't just about Israel's unfaithfulness.
They did break the covenant, though.
They did. But Lane says it was also part of God's plan all along to bring about this new covenant.
So it's not like God was caught off guard or had to come up with a plan B.
Right. It was all part of his redemptive purpose unfolding over time.
That's why Hebrews says that Jesus is the mediator of a better covenant with better promises.
Exactly. And that makes the old covenant obsolete. Hebrews 8 is very clear about that.
So it's not that the old covenant was bad?
No, not at all. It served its purpose.
But it was pointing towards something even greater.
Yes, it was a shadow of what was to come.
Okay, that makes sense. But there are some similarities between the two covenants, right?
Oh, absolutely. Peterson emphasizes that it's not a complete break with the past. There's continuity.
Like what?
Well, both covenants were initially given to Israel.
Okay, right.
Although Hebrews makes it clear that the new covenant extends to believing Jews and Gentiles.
The church.
The church. It expands the scope of who's included.
Okay, so both covenants start with Israel, but the new covenant expands outwards.
Exactly. Another similarity. Both covenants came after a significant act of redemption.
Okay, yeah. The Exodus for the old covenant.
Right. And for the new covenant, it's the return from Babylonian exile.
Which is actually the context for Jeremiah's prophecy.
Exactly. And both covenants took effect after a death.
The sacrificial animals in the old covenant.
And the sacrifice of Christ in the new covenant.
So even though they're different, they share some core elements.
Right. But here's a really crucial point. The essential content of the covenant, it's the same.
Really? What do you mean?
God's law. Remember, Jeremiah says, I will put my law within them and write it on their hearts.
No.
Peterson brings in Lane again, who clarifies that it's not about new content. The law itself doesn't change.
Okay, so what's new about it?
The way it's presented. It's internalized. It becomes part of who we are, written on our hearts.
So it's not just external rules anymore, but an internal transformation.
Exactly. It's about the heart's response to God.
That's profound. So what would you say is Jeremiah's main contribution here?
I think it's this incredible passage about the new covenant. It brings to a climax that relationship between God and his people.
That goes all the way back to Abraham.
Exactly. And of course, Jesus is the one who makes it all possible.
Right. Through his death and resurrection.
He's the mediator of the new covenant, as Hebrews tells us. He's the key to it all.
Absolutely. And what about the benefits of the new covenant? What does it mean for us today?
Well, Peterson explains that believers, New Testament believers, we experience those benefits right now.
Okay, like what?
Regeneration, you know, born again.
Right.
The indwelling of God's word.
Having his word in our hearts.
A personal knowledge of God.
Not just knowing about him, but knowing him personally.
Exactly. And forgiveness of sins.
Wow, that's huge.
It is. But the full realization of all these blessings, that's coming later.
In the eternal state.
Yep. Resurrection, eternal life on the new earth. The best is yet to come.
So exciting. All right, so we've covered the Davidic and New Covenants. What else does Peterson talk about?
Okay, now he shifts gears a bit and talks about the people of God and their election.
Election.
Yeah, God choosing a people for himself. And Peterson makes a really important point. This didn't start with the New Testament church.
Oh, interesting.
It goes all the way back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The patriarchs.
So the roots of election go deep into the Old Testament.
It's very deep. The nation of Israel was the primary focus of God's choosing love in the Old Testament.
Okay, so it started with the nation, not just individuals.
Exactly. And what's fascinating is that God didn't choose Abraham based on some foreseen faith or good works.
Really? Why did he choose him then?
Peterson quotes House, who points out that Abraham came from a family of idolaters.
Oh, wow. So not exactly a spiritual giant.
Nope. But House interprets it as God selecting an individual for his plan out of his own free will and mercy.
So God chose him because he wanted to, not because Abraham earned it.
Exactly. That's pure grace right there.
Yeah.
And that sets the pattern for how God's election works.
So it's not about us deserving it, but about God's sovereign choice.
It's a humbling thought. And this choosing, it wasn't limited to Abraham.
Right. It extended to his descendants.
Yep. To Isaac and Jacob.
Yeah.
Peterson points to Genesis 25.23, where God tells Rebecca about her twin sons before they're even born.
And God loved Jacob, but didn't choose Esau.
Right. That's explicitly stated in Malachi 1 and Romans 9. And Peterson quotes Barton Payne, who calls Jacob.
Wait, Jacob, the guy who tricked his brother and stole his blessing.
That's the one. Payne calls him the most striking example of unconditional election.
Wow, that's saying something.
It is. Jacob was chosen before birth, he was the younger twin, and he wasn't exactly known for his ethical behavior.
So God's choice clearly wasn't based on Jacob's merit.
It's a great illustration that God chooses who he chooses, and his ways are not our ways.
It's all about his purpose, his plan.
Exactly. And speaking of purpose, Peterson highlights the reason God chose these patriarchs.
What was it?
It wasn't just about them. He wanted to bring forth a nation, the nation of Israel.
Okay, so it's bigger than just individual salvation.
Much bigger. This nation would be the one God would enter into covenant with.
And claim as his own people.
Exactly. Peterson then takes us to Deuteronomy, which has several passages that make this really clear.
Okay, which ones?
Deuteronomy 4.3738, 7.68, 10.1415, and 14.2. All these verses emphasize God's choice of Israel.
So Deuteronomy really hammers home this point about God's election of Israel.
It does. And what do those verses tell us? First, God is Lord of all. He's in charge.
Right.
Second, he chose Israel alone. Not any other nation.
Okay.
Third, not because they were big and powerful. They were actually the smallest and weakest.
So it wasn't about their strength or numbers.
Nope. Fourth, he chose them because of his love for the patriarchs.
So it goes back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
It all starts there.
Yeah.
And fifth, his choice was the reason he rescued them from Egypt and gave them the promised land.
So their election was the basis for everything else God did for them.
Exactly. Now, God didn't choose them and then say, okay, do whatever you want.
Right. There were expectations.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Peterson emphasizes that God expected a response from Israel.
Like what?
They were to acknowledge him as the one true God, and they were to obey his commands.
So their election came with responsibilities.
Yes. It wasn't a free pass. It was a call to relationship and obedience.
Okay, that makes sense. But God's plan wasn't just about Israel.
You got it. Remember, back in Genesis 12:1-3, God tells Abraham, he's going to bless all peoples through him.
Oh,
he's going to make him into a great nation, give him land, and through him, all nations will be blessed.
And that's reaffirmed after the sacrifice of Isaac in Genesis 22.
Yep. And ultimately, that promise finds its fulfillment in Jesus Christ, as Galatians tells us.
So even in choosing Israel, God had a bigger plan in mind.
Absolutely. And Peterson quotes Wright, who emphasizes that Israel's election wasn't just about their own salvation.
Okay, it was bigger than that.
It was missional. They were chosen to be a light to the nations, a means of bringing salvation to others.
An instrument to gather that multinational multitude.
Exactly. So their election wasn't just for them, it was for the whole world.
That's an amazing thought. So from election, where do we go next?
Well, Peterson then takes us to the dramatic story of the Exodus.
Ah, the redemption from bondage.
Yeah. He argues that this event, their rescue from slavery in Egypt, it fundamentally shaped Israel's identity as the people of God.
It makes sense. That experience would have been so powerful.
It was. And it showcased God as their deliverer, a warrior God who fought for them against Pharaoh.
Right. He wasn't just a God of words, but a God of action.
Absolutely. And Peterson brings in Stuart, who calls Exodus 6.6-8 a blueprint for God's actions.
So that passage outlines what God was going to do and how Israel should understand themselves.
Exactly. And Waldenke, Peterson quotes him too, he calls the Exodus the defining act of deliverance in the Old Testament.
I like that. Defining act of deliverance.
It's a great phrase.
Yeah.
And it was through this event that God claimed those former slaves as his own people.
They had been in Egypt for 400 years, right?
Yep, 4 centuries of captivity, and their cries for help, they reached God.
And he remembered his covenant.
He did, the one he made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he acted.
It's amazing how God hears the cries of the oppressed.
It is. It shows his compassion, his faithfulness.
And Peterson reminds us just how powerless Israel was in Egypt. They had nothing.
Stewart calls them a non-citizen gang of slaves. No land, no hope.
But God stepped in with a mighty hand.
That's right. And not just to set them free, but to give them a permanent home.
Fulfilling his covenant promises.
Yes, and then you have this powerful image in Exodus 4:21-23. God calls Israel my son, his firstborn.
Wow, that's a strong statement.
It is. Peterson highlights the significance of that phrase, especially when you contrast it with the fate of Egypt's firstborn.
Right, the 10th plague. Devastating.
It shows the tender and protected relationship God had with Israel.
They were his chosen people, his treasured possession.
And right, Peterson quotes him too, right? Says that Israel wasn't adopted by God.
Okay.
They were formed by him through his sovereign election, not their own choice.
So God made them who they were.
It's a really profound thought. And then there's this contrast between Israel as my people and Pharaoh and the Egyptians.
Right. They didn't recognize Yahweh.
They didn't. Peterson points out that Pharaoh, despite all the Egyptian gods, he didn't even know Yahweh.
And God keeps saying, I am the Lord.
Over and over again. It's a declaration of his power and authority.
It's like he's introducing himself to the world.
Exactly. And Peterson talks about God revealing his name. In Exodus 6:1-5.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's not that God's name was unknown before. Peterson quotes Salehammer, who suggests that it was a new level of intimacy.
Okay.
A face-to-face encounter with Moses. And then there's this little detail about the mixed multitude who left Egypt with the Israelites.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Egyptians who joined them. Maybe they saw the power of God and decided to follow him.
It's like a little preview of the Gentiles being included in God's plan.
Exactly. Peterson sees it as a hint of the fulfillment of that promise to Abraham in Genesis 12:3.
That all nations would be blessed through him.
Right. And the Exodus was also a direct fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham in Genesis 15.
The one about the 400 years of sojourn and slavery.
That's the one. And leaving with great possessions.
Which they did, right. They took all the gold and silver from the Egyptians.
Yep. So the Exodus wasn't just a random event. It was fulfilling God's promises. His plan unfolding.
And it was a showdown, wasn't it? Between Yahweh and Pharaoh and the Egyptian gods.
Oh, yeah. Cosmic battle. And even the Egyptian magicians, they had to admit at one point, this is the finger of God.
They couldn't deny his power.
Nope. And then you have the whole story of Pharaoh's hardened heart.
Yeah, that's a tricky one.
It is. Peterson points out that the Bible says God hardened Pharaoh's heart 10 times.
10 times.
But Pharaoh also hardened his own heart 10 times.
So it's both God's sovereignty and Pharaoh's own stubbornness.
Exactly. And Peterson details Pharaoh's minor concessions and broken promises.
You know, it's like he kept trying to negotiate with God, but he wasn't really willing to submit.
He wanted to do things his way, not God's way. And ultimately, God's judgment fell on the Egyptian deities through the plagues.
Yeah, each plague seemed to target a specific god or goddess.
It's like God was saying, I am the Lord and there is no other.
A powerful demonstration of his power and authority.
Absolutely. Now, what's really striking about the plagues is the distinction God made between the Egyptians and the Israelites.
Right. Goshen was spared.
God protected his people while he judged Egypt. It's a powerful picture of his love and care.
Peterson quotes Stewart, who calls the plagues a natural phenomena with a clear divine purpose.
It wasn't random chaos. God was in control. And the climax of this distinction was the Passover.
The sparing of the firstborn sons through the blood of the lamb.
It was redemption for Israel and judgment for Egypt.
And there was a great cry in Egypt that night.
Imagine the devastation, the grief. But for Israel, it was their greatest act of deliverance.
A night they would never forget.
And Peterson reminds us that Deuteronomy 4 calls it being brought out of the iron furnace of Egypt to become God's inheritance.
They were his treasured possession, set apart for his purposes.
Exactly. And that brings us to the Sinai Covenant.
Okay, what happened there?
Well, 3 months after the Exodus, God establishes a covenant with Israel.
Not just with individuals, but with the whole nation.
Exactly. And that highlights their unique status.
They were God's chosen people, set apart from all others.
Peterson takes us to Exodus 19:5-6, where God calls them his treasured possession.
Yes, segula.
Yeah. Peterson explains that word, quoting Walt Clegg. It means a king's private treasure, something very valuable.
So Israel was God's most prized possession.
Absolutely. He also calls them a kingdom of priests and a holy nation.
But those were conditional, right? Dependent on their obedience.
That's right. And Peterson points out that kingdom of priests means they were supposed to represent God to the nations.
A missional calling.
Exactly. And holy nation means displaying God's character to the world, being a light in the darkness.
So their identity was tied to their relationship with God and their mission to the world?
It all went together. When we think about it, their transformation was incredible.
From slaves to God's treasured possession, a kingdom of priests, a holy nation.
It's an amazing picture of what God can do. He takes the lowly and raises them up.
And all of this helps us understand who the people of God were in the Old Testament.
Exactly. Their identity was shaped by those covenants, those moments of redemption.
Those were just random events. They were God's plan unfolding, revealing his character and his love for his people.
And it makes you think, doesn't it?
Mm.
What does it mean for us today to be part of the people of God?
It's a question worth pondering. How does God's work in the Old Testament inform our understanding of who we are and what we're called to do?